and they did it right manfully.
I thought you were going to speak the truth and say madly. However, that is just what I had in mind. We said that love was a kind of madness, did we not?
Yes.
And that there are two kinds of madness, one arising from human diseases, and the other from a divine release from the customary habits.
Certainly.
And we made four divisions of the divine madness, ascribing them to four gods, saying that prophecy was inspired by Apollo, the mystic madness by Dionysus, the poetic by the Muses, and the madness of love, inspired by Aphrodite and Eros, we said was the best. We described the passion of love in some sort of figurative manner, expressing some truth, perhaps, and perhaps being led away in another direction, and after composing a somewhat plausible discourse, we chanted a sportive and mythic hymn in mittened pious strain to the honor of your lord and mine, Phaedrus, love, the guardian of beautiful boys.
Yes, and I found it very pleasant to hear.
Here let us take up this point, and see how the discourse succeeded, in passing from blame to praise.
What do you mean?
It seems to me, that the discourse was, as a whole, really sportive jest, but in these chance utterances were involved two principles, the essence of which it would be gratifying to learn, if art could teach it.
What principles?
That of perceiving and bringing together in one idea the scattered particulars, that one may make clear by definition the particular thing which he wishes to explain. Just as now, in speaking of love, we said what he is and defined it, whether well or ill, certainly by this means the discourse acquired clearness and consistency.
And what is the other principle, Socrates?
That of dividing things again by classes, where the natural joints are, and not trying to break any part, after the manner of a bad carver, as our two discourses just now assumed one common principle, unreason, and then, just as the body, which is one, is naturally divisible into two, right and left, with parts called by the same names, so our two discourses conceived of madness is naturally one principle within us, and one discourse, cutting off the left-hand part, continued to divide this until it found among its parts a sort of left-handed love, which it very justly reviled, but the other discourse, leading us to the right-hand part of madness, found a love having the same name as the first, but divine, which it held up to view, and praised as the author of our greatest blessings.
Very true.
Now I myself, Phaedrus, am a lover of these processes of division and bringing together, as aids to speech and thought, and if I think any other man is able to see things that can naturally be collected into one and divided into many, him I follow after and walk in his footsteps, as if he were a god, and whether the name I give to those who can do this is right or wrong, God knows, but I have called them hitherto dialecticians. But tell me now, what name to give to those who are taught by you and Lysias, or is this that art of speech by means, of which Thrasymachus and the rest have become able speakers themselves, and make others so, if they are willing to pay them royal tribute?
They are royal men, but not trained in the matters about which you ask. I think you give this method the right name when you call it dialectic, but it seems to me that rhetoric still escapes us.
What do you mean? Can there be anything of importance which is not included in these processes, and yet comes under the head of art? Certainly you and I must not neglect it, but must say what it is that remains of rhetoric.
A great many things remain, Socrates, the things that are written in the books on rhetoric.
Thank you for reminding me. You mean that there must be an introduction first, at the beginning of the discourse? These are the things you mean, are they not, the niceties of the art?
Yes.
And the narrative must come second with the testimony after it, and third the proofs, and fourth the probabilities, and confirmation and further confirmation are mentioned, I believe, by the man from Byzantium, that most excellent artist in words.
You mean the worthy Theodorus?
Of course, and he tells how refutation and further refutation must be accomplished, both in accusation and in defense. Shall we not bring the illustrious Parian, Evenus, into our discussion, who invented covert allusion and indirect praises, and some say that he also wrote indirect censures, composing them in verses an aid to memory, for he is a clever man, and shall we leave Gorgias and Titius undisturbed, who saw that probabilities are more to be esteemed than truths, who make small things seem great and great things small by the power of their words, and new things old and old things the reverse, and who invented conciseness of speech, and measureless length on all subjects. And once when Prodicus heard these inventions, he laughed, and said that he alone had discovered the art of proper speech, that discourses should be neither long nor short, but of reasonable length.
O Prodicus, how clever!
And shall we not mention Hippias, our friend from Elis? I think he would agree with him.
Oh yes.
And what shall we say of Polus, and his shrines of learned speech, such as duplication and sententiousness and figurativeness, and what of the names with which Lysimachus presented him to affect beautiful action?
Were there not some similar inventions of Protagoras, Socrates?
Yes, my boy, correctness of diction, and many other fine things, for tearful speeches, to arouse pity for old age and poverty. I think the precepts of the mighty Chalcedonian hold the palm, and he is also a genius, as he said, at rousing large companies to wrath, and soothing them again by his charms when they are angry, and most powerful in devising and abolishing calumnies on any grounds whatsoever, but all seem to be in agreement concerning the conclusion of discourses, which some call recapitulation, while others give it some other name.
You mean making a summary of the points of the speech at the end of it, so as to remind the hearers of what has been said?
These are the things I mean, these and anything else you can mention concerned with the art of rhetoric.
There are only little things, not worth mentioning.
Never mind the little things, let us bring these other things more under the light, and see what force of art they have, and when.
They have a very powerful force, at least in large assemblies.
They have, but my friend, see if you agree with me in thinking that their warp has gaps in it.
Go on and show them.
Tell me, if anyone should go to your friend Eriximachus, or to his father Acumenus, and should say, I know how to apply various drugs to people, so as to make them warm, or, if I wish, cold, and I can make them vomit, if I like, or can make their bowels move, and all that sort of thing, and because of this knowledge I claim the term of physician, and can make any other man a physician, to whom I impart the knowledge of these things, what do you think they would say?
They would ask him, of course, whether he knew also whom he ought to cause to do these things, and when, and how much.
If then he should say, no, not at all, but I think that he who has learned these things from me will be able to do by himself the things you ask about.
They would say, I fancy, that the man was crazy, and because he had read something in a book, or had stumbled upon some medicines, imagined that he was a physician, when he really had no knowledge of the art.
And what if someone should go to Sophocles or Euripides, and should say, that he knew how to make very long speeches about a small matter, and very short ones about a great affair, and pitiful utterances, if he wished, and again terrible and threatening ones, and all that sort of thing, and that he thought, by imparting those things he could teach the art of writing tragedies.
They also, I fancy, Socrates, would laugh at him, if he imagined that tragedy was anything else than the proper combination of these details in such a way, that they harmonize with each other, and with the whole composition.
But they would not, I suppose, rebuke him harshly, but they would behave as a musician would, if he met a man who thought he understood harmony, because he could strike the highest and lowest notes. He would not say roughly, you wretch, you are mad, but being a musician, he would say in gentle tones, my friend, he who is to be a harmonist must know these things you mention, but nothing prevents one who is at your stage of knowledge from being quite ignorant of harmony. You know the necessary preliminaries of harmony, but not harmony itself.
Quite correct.
So Sophocles would say, that the man exhibited the preliminaries of tragedy, not tragedy itself, and Acumenus that he knew the preliminaries of medicine, not medicine itself.
Exactly so.
Well then, if the mellifluous Adrastus or Pericles heard of the excellent accomplishments which we just enumerated, bricologies and figurative speech and all the other things we said we must bring to the light and examine, do we suppose they would, like you and me, be so ill-bred as to speak discourteously of those who have written and taught these things as the art of rhetoric, would they not, since they are wiser than me, censure us also and say, Phaedrus and Socrates, we ought not to be angry, but lenient, if certain persons who are ignorant of dialectics have been unable to define the nature of rhetoric, and on this account have thought, when they possessed the knowledge, that is a necessary preliminary to rhetoric, that they had discovered rhetoric, and believe that by teaching these preliminaries to others they have taught them rhetoric completely, and that the persuasive use of these details, and the composition of the whole discourse is a small matter which their pupils must apply themselves in their writings or speeches.
Well, Socrates, it does seem as if that which those men teach and write about as the art of rhetoric were such as you describe. I think you are right, but how and from whom is the truly rhetorical and persuasive art to be acquired?
Whether one can acquire it so as to become a perfect orator, Phaedrus, is probably, and perhaps must be, dependent on conditions, like everything else. If you are naturally rhetorical, you will become a notable orator, when to your natural endowments you have added knowledge and practice. At whatever point you are deficient in these, you will be incomplete, but so far as the art is concerned, I do not think the quest of it lies along the path of Lysias and Thrasymachus.
Where then?
I suppose, my friend, Pericles is the most perfect orator in existence.
Well?
All great arts demand discussion and high speculation about nature, for this loftiness of mind and effectiveness in all directions seem somehow to come from such pursuits. This was in Pericles added to his great natural abilities, for it was, I think, his falling in with Anaxagoras, who was just such a man, that filled him with high thoughts, and taught him the nature of mind, and of lack of mind, subjects about which Anaxagoras used chiefly to discourse, and from these speculations he drew, and applied to the art of speaking, what is of use to it.
What do you mean by that?
The method of the art of healing is much the same as that of rhetoric.
How so?
In both cases you must analyze a nature, in one that of the body, and in the other that of the soul, if you are to proceed in a scientific manner, not merely by practice and routine. To impart health and strength to the body by prescribing medicine and diet, or by proper discourses and trading, to give to the soul the desired belief and virtue.
That, Socrates, is probably true.
Now, do you think one can acquire any appreciable knowledge of the nature of the soul without knowing the nature of the whole man?
If Hippocrates the Asclepiad is to be trusted, one cannot know the nature of the body, either, except in that way.
He is right. My friend, however, we ought not to be content with the authority of Hippocrates, but to see also, if our reason agrees with him on examination.
I assent.
Then see what Hippocrates and true reason say about nature. In considering the nature of anything, must we not consider first, whether that in respect to which we wish to be learned ourselves, and to make others learned is simple or multiform, and then, if it is simple, inquire what power of acting it possesses, or of being acted upon, and by what, and if it has many forms, number them, and then see in the case of each form, as we did in the case of the simple nature, what its action is, and how it is acted upon and by what.
Very likely, Socrates.
At any rate, any other mode of procedure would be like the progress of a blind man, yet surely he who pursues any study scientifically ought not to be comparable to a blind or a deaf man. But evidently the man whose rhetorical teaching is a real art will explain accurately the nature of that to which his words are to be addressed, and that is the soul, is it not?
Of course.
Then this is the goal of all his effort. He tries to produce conviction in the soul, is not that so?
Yes.
So it is clear that Thrasymachus, or anyone else who seriously teaches the art of rhetoric, will first describe the soul with perfect accuracy, and make us see whether it is one and all alike, or, like the body, of multiform aspect, for this is what we call explaining its nature.
Certainly.
And secondly, he will say what its action is, and toward what it is directed, or how it is acted upon and by what.
To be sure.
Thirdly, he will classify the speeches and the souls, and will adapt each to the other, showing the causes of the effects produced, and why one kind of soul is necessarily persuaded by certain classes of speeches, and another is not.